simple.
How would you like it? Wait, just a minute. Let me turn this thing down. How would you like it if I went downtown and got a plate of steamed clams for you, huh? For me, for both of us. Let's say a bucket of steamed clams. Now, with some butter. Now, I know a place that stays open all night where I can get steamed clams, baby. How would you like that tonight? No, seriously. Oh, come on. Forget about the diet once, you know? I don't know what there is. I think maybe you get it from your mother. But what is this thing? I mean, what do you think's going to catch up with you if you eat 4 calories too much one day? And what do you think is going to happen if you do get fat? I mean, what do you think? How about some clams? Come on. And I don't want to. I mean, I don't want them by myself. It's no fun, you know. There's three things you don't do by yourself. One of them is drinking, one of them is eating clams, and the other, well. So how about it? How about some clams? Why don't you just once? Look, let me turn this thing down for a minute. All right. Now, I'm not going to turn it all the way down. No. Okay. Is this okay? Who is this, by the way? Okay, all right. No clams tonight, you're right. Okay, diet, you're right. All right. Okay. No, I'm not mad. What do you mean, clams? I can get something out of the refrigerator. Yeah, that's right. Look. Listen, you know what I would like to see happen once, just once? I would like just once to have something that was unpleasant to you, something that you didn't want to do. I would like you just once to do it just for me. Now, you're always doing things for me, you know. But when it's finally said and done, it turns out you wanted to do them anyway. And then you come around and say, well, look at this. I got you this thing here, this beautiful thing. And you just love to buy things, that's all. And the reason that you want it, you got it, is because you like to buy things. And then you pretend that you bought it for me, that it was a thing you were doing for me. Get off my back. No, this has nothing to do with clams. Oh, clams. I don't want any clams now. A couple of minutes ago, all right, clams were right. You know, there's a funny thing about whether a thing, whether you want to do, how you, and why you want to do. Have you ever stopped to think of why a person wants to do a thing? Well, part of it is the time in which he wants to do it, you know? I could not, no, I do not want any clams. Now, forget the clams. And I'm not mad at all. But you know, I'll tell you, there was an article. Did you read the article in the Times today? I'll tell you what. There was an article in the Times today, baby, and I'm going to sit here and I'm going to sit you down. I'm going to read it. It's about the changing status of women. Changing status of men is what they should have written the article about. Changing status of women, my foot. You know what? You know, I'll tell you, most chicks today want to be treated as though they are tender flowers, and they prefer to act like King Kong. You see, there's that neat split. You want me to pick up your handkerchief while you are kicking me in the duff with a pair of hobnail boots. Now, which do you want? Now, I can do either and can take either. If you want me to pick the handkerchief up and swing the doors, if you want me to go around spraying chlorophyll into the corners, you know, if you want me to sweep, if you want me to polish the plants, if you want me to pet the kitty, if you want me to do all those things for you, I will be glad to do them for you. But you better act like you want them done. As though, you know what, do you have any idea what chivalry was based on? You know, you're always bringing me up this chivalry business. I'm not chivalrous. My foot, I'm not chivalrous. Well, that's a matter of definition. And look, you should talk about love. What are you all crying out loud? Listen, I have come to believe that there is no such thing as love. That men don't know what love is. Women don't know what love is. We just got this word that floats around, and it's confusing the whole issue. And I'm not talking about clams, so get the clams out of your mind. I do not want any clams. Oh, I don't care if he hears it or not. Look, what do you think that I worry whether or not the neighbors hear what I have to say? I don't even know that idiot. Nor do I want it. Oh, look it. Listen, are you going to sit down for 1 minute and just listen to me? Just listen now. Chivalry was based on a premise that women were unable to do things. And so a man went out and fought the bear for this chick because she couldn't do it. You dig? You bring home twice the paycheck that I bring home. How many bears am I going to kill for you? And then you say, well, it belongs to both of us. Belongs to both of us, my foot. You brought it home. You killed it. You knocked the bear on the head. You bring it home and say, honey, it doesn't make any difference. It's for both of us. Yes, I would be a lot happier if we were poor. P-O-O-O-O-R-E, poor. Poor. I don't care if we could pay for the high fire or not. You see, look. Need is not based at all in this day and age on need. Understand what I mean? We don't need a hi-fi. No, what do you mean we don't need it? Look, I didn't ask you whether you liked it or not, or whether I liked it. I said you don't need it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. We do not need to live in a 5.5 room efficiency. Efficiency, my foot. You know what efficiency means? Listen, this thing takes more uptake, more updig, more up-outgo. Efficient. I live in it about 30 seconds a year, and I pay $400,000 a year. Is that efficiency? Efficiency. All right, we don't have to have that. This is the stuff that your salary pays for, and so you say, well, we've got to have it. It belongs to both of us, my foot. Now, look. No, I do not want clams. I am not interested in clams. All I'm trying to tell you, why do we get into these idiotic... Oh, God. Yeah. I don't know. You know what I have a feeling is going to happen one day? I have a feeling that one day, in the very near future, a gigantic argument is going to break out between men and women. Here in the United States, it's going to start in the United States. It's going to spread all over the world, Daddy, in 30 seconds. But it's going to start right here. It's going to start right here. Maybe it's going to start in some place like Youngstown, Ohio. Some poor clown is going to come out of a department store with two air conditioners and a freezer on his back. And his wife is going to say something to him. And he's going to just open his mouth like saying, my back hurts. And she's going to say, what do you mean? Don't you love me or what? For crying out loud, you're insignificant anyway. Look, I can tell you that if a guy, you know how you make a man feel insignificant, baby? Not the ways that people think. No. It's by. Let's take an instance. It's like the chick says, "I'll tell you, what we ought to do is put up a shelf." He says, fine, all right. And she says, all right, let's put it up right over here. He says, well, I thought maybe it should go. She says, no, I think it should go here. Right over here, you see, because I'm in here more than you are, and I think that it should go here. She says, okay. So he starts to put up the shelf. Are you following this hypothetical guy? He ain't Cary Grant, by the way. So he's putting up the shelf. And suddenly the chick says, look, why don't you drill holes first before you put the nail? But drill the hole first, and then it won't slip. So he starts to drill the hole. And then after it's all over, she says, "That was a beautiful job you did." Then 2 days later, she says, "You know what we ought to do? We ought to paint the closet." And it starts all over again, but this time he's a little slower on starting to paint the closet. And she says, "You know, the trouble with you, Charlie, is that you're a lazy lunk, in addition to not being able to paint closets." She doesn't say it, you see. What she says is that if anything's going to get done around here, I have to get it started. That's the attitude, you know. If anything is going to get done around here. In other words, if anybody's going to get kicked in the duff, I have to do the kicking. Boom, get going. And he starts painting in his little nest. I don't know how I got on it. Yeah. Listen, how would you like a big cheeseburger? A big cheeseburger with Bermuda onions. Huh? And some relish. And some kosher dill pickles. The new ones? How about it? No. Look, I'm asking you about hamburgers. I do not want any clams now. Can't you get it through your head that clams... It's too late for clams. Too late. All right, okay. Okay, do you want them with vinegar sauce or butter? I guess you're right. Yeah, some clams, eh? You want some beer with it? Okay. Where'd you put the keys to the car? Hey, listen, do you want me to bring back the juice? I will make you a clam juice spinet. And I will not tell you what a clam juice spinet is until I make it for you, baby, and it will make your old eyeballs glow. You will accept, I'll tell you, you won't know whether you're eating cheeseburgers or clams after that. And I will look like a man after that. Which is to say, it'll take away a little of your inhibitions. Oh, I'd say about a half hour. I shall return. Watch. I'll wear this. Watch me put on my sunglasses. I shall return. Yeah. I can see why guys want to be generals. Stop stepping on me. Do not tread on me. Speaking of the heavy tread, this is WOR AM and FM in New York. The Big Apple marching endlessly down a ringing corridor of history. Bonk, bonk. The other night, I'm turning around, just twisting the knob on the television set, and who stares me right in the face but Boris Karloff, all dressed up like Frankenstein's monster. And he is treading along in that terrible, that pained, somehow sad, unhappy tread of a monster, a man who has been made out of other men. Oomp, 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 oomp. And then there's the scene where he looks right out at the camera and says, "Me made from dead man." And the little dwarf was, and he waves the torch in his face, "Me made from dead man." And I'm looking at this, and it's looking right out at me, and just as his face turns to me, and that those glowing, sad, dead eyes look out at me, "Me made from dead man," you hear, and out came Harry and Bert, right in the middle of this cosmic scene, and I knew I was right back in Wonderland. I knew that as long as that magic rabbit is running along that long, long magic tunnel down deep into the bowels of the earth, there ain't going to be no turning back for any of us. And I can't feel any real fear, you know. One of the things that bothers me really terribly about myself is that I feel unable to actually feel any genuine fear about the fate of mankind, one way or the other. I mean, any actual, true, quaking fear. I'm constantly amused. I'll tell you, sometimes I blow a gasket. I blew a gasket the other day on the Fifth Avenue bus, right there in front of everybody. We were right there in the sight of the gardens there on Rockefeller Plaza, and the pansies were looking up, and the nasturtiums were growing there, and the carnations were flowing in the breeze, and I'm sitting there reading the car ads. And there's a guy looking down at my face, and he's looking at me with his face on a photograph, and he says to me, "Have you tried emotional appeal?" And then there's a little asterisk next to emotional appeal. Underneath it, it says, "Registered copyright." He has copyrighted emotional appeal. I wonder whether or not somebody has copyrighted blatant emotionalism, or let's say flagrant sentimentality, patented by Shepard. If you're going to use any of that, I hold it, and you're infringing upon my patents. Stand back, I'm an eagle. And then I found that all kinds of things of that nature were patented. And he's looking down right at me, and he says, "Have you tried emotional appeal?" And I couldn't help it. It just all of a sudden, it all welled up, you know, just like Kim Stanley in the key scene in the second act. It just welled up inside of me, and I thought, yes, I have tried it, and it hasn't worked. And his face just looked down there with that big, bland, wonderful, happy Babbitt, Norman Vincent Peale smile, and he just kept saying to me over and over again in big black print, "Have you tried emotional appeal?" And then there were all kinds of little subtitles underneath it, you know, with a big round dot next to it. It said emotional appeal, and one of them said instant dynamic action. I haven't tried that either, actually. I'll be perfectly honest with you, Mr. Emotional Appeal. I haven't tried dynamic action for a long time. And I'm sitting there. Of course, I began to realize that underneath it all, he had prodded me, you see. And I'm very embarrassed because then I began to understand that he is using emotional appeal on me because it's the judicious use of the words, "Have you tried emotional appeal?" The implication being there that everything else has failed. Which is quite true. There's no getting around it. And I'm beginning to see now that most successful men literally do this. That we deal, and of course using the term success in its... By the way, will somebody please look up the word success for me? I mean, really look it up for me. And while you're about it, Since it's quite obvious that emotional appeal is going to carry the day for, that's a trademark now, isn't it? Emotional appeal, trade name, yes. It's funny. Some guys have. I understand that there was a recent copyright given on a very interesting three-letter word. You're impinging on somebody's copyright now constantly. Somebody owns the rights, actually, the subsidiary movie rights. He's really fixed it up. But while I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about this emotional appeal, and I begin to understand something about it, you know. That the more you stand and the more you kneel, in a sense, at the base of a marble statue, the more you will believe that the marble statue did it. Literally, truly did it. And this is one of the great principles of the dictator. That as soon as you get in, put up a few statues. Then you become forever and ever immobile. Did you read about the statue that got the head knocked off recently? All the insurgents got mad and blew the head off the statue in one of the fist-fighting countries recently. And they were going to blow up a statue of a former hero, you see. And they put a lot of dynamite under it, and as soon as the revolution was completed, they set the fuse and boom! And all that came off was the head, which weighed about 45 tons, that bounced and rolled down the street like a big marble, and they prodded it and pushed it, and finally they got it in the river. And there it lay at the bottom of the river, this great big old head of a former hero. And then, of course, the counter-revolution happened, as is always the case in history. We are just itsy bitsy little corks bobbing in a fantastic maelstrom of our own making. Because you see, if we didn't have that maelstrom, do you realize how dull it would be? I mean, if there was no trouble in the world, what would you do? You just sit on your duff and wait for it to happen. Death. You just sit there. Nothing, you know? And so trouble is actually the true pleasure in the world. It really is. If you don't think so, pick up the average magazine and find out how many stories are about happiness and how many are about trouble. Just mix them up and put them together. And you will find that trouble equates happiness. And happiness equates trouble. And there are many, many very ancient Eastern philosophers who have made that observation. That without trouble, a man is no man. And of course, without man, there is no trouble. They are inseparable. They go and they march side by side, one and the other, one and one, throughout the pages of history. All of history is nothing but trouble. It's nothing but a gigantic diary of problems, gigantic, enormous fistfights. And, of course, then we had the Hundred Years' War. Well, actually, it hasn't been a Hundred Years' War. It's been more like a 2-million-year war. It's been much more than just 100 years. And we always had this great belief that somehow one day it's all going to stop. Well, when it all stops, there just won't be any people left. That is the final solution. There's no such thing, you know, as a non-carnivorous carnivore. They just don't exist. Of course, this is another one of the problems of people. They like to think that a tiger who purrs is somehow not a tiger. A tiger who nuzzles up against you, you know, and rubs back and forth is still not he's not a tiger anymore, you know. It's like this poor sad book about the lion that has recently been making. You know the psychological reasons why people are fascinated with the idea of this lion. You know this thing of the lioness, where these people took the lion cub and they finally took her back to the jungle, and the idea being that she really isn't a lion. She's just one of us, you know. Ah, yes, sir, that's my baby. Oh, sir, don't mean maybe. Again, it's a part of the old illusion that man is perfectible, as are tigers and lions. Well, we couldn't possibly enjoy a lion. The reason we like that lion is because that lion went immediately back into the jungle and began to kill zebras, hence became a true lion. Then she became a bestseller. If the book had been written that this lion made the grade, crossed over, passed, and became one of us, went back to the jungle, and was killed by a zebra, the book wouldn't have sold 3 copies. So we really don't want to change gold into lead, nor vice versa. That we would hate, we would honestly begin to hate lead if we could change it to gold. And we would certainly have no respect for gold if we change it to lead. And along with this, the great belief of the assembled multitude of united old ladies of all history who have believed that somehow man has a transistor circuit in him that one day is going to be fixed by a little adjustment. He will cease to be a carnivore. Sir, that's my baby. No, sir, don't mean maybe. Yes, and another thing. There are no non-combatants in this war. It is true that there are PFCs and there are generals. That's quite true. But there ain't no civilians in this war that has gone on. How long do they say now? 2 million years, maybe, they say man has been on Earth. 2 million years. You know, there was a historic moment that was recorded by one of the great physical anthropologists at the University of Pennsylvania. And he has reconstructed it. I thought you might like to know about it. It was the time that man became man. It was a very important moment. These two guys are sitting on the shores of this antediluvian lake, an ancient primeval water. And you know, in those days, it was interesting. There were no trees. Have you noticed New York is becoming a city of trees now? You notice that? It's very pleasant over there on Fifth Avenue. One day, not long ago, something happened to the shoulder of a guy's washable, wearable Dacron suit. Just dropped right out of the sky from a tree above him. And it wasn't a pigeon that did it. It was a bluebird. And somehow he just... funny thing, I was with the guy and I says, aren't you going to take it off? I mean, aren't you going to wipe aren't you going to do something? He says, no, I'm going to leave it there. It was a bluebird. And the bluebird of happiness finally did it on his shoulder. A bluebird right here on Madison Avenue, right flying over there by Fifth and into the plane trees, right there offshore, right there next to where the waters of Gitche Gumee lap up there next to the great fountain of Rockefeller. K-chung, k-chung, just washes back and forth there. But, you know, I'm well, you're interested in the story, huh? I mean, you want to know how we came to be? Oh, come on now. That's not important, is it, really? Of course not. We are what we are. I will award the brass figligee with bronze oak leaf palm to the one of you. One of you. And I want it to be a chick this time. I've noticed this, that men answer questions, chicks sit there with roguishly dancing, enigmatic eyes and say, listen to this idiot. Well, I have a sneaking suspicion that there are some underground idiots among the women. And is there one of you who can tell me I am what I am and that's all that I am? Spelled Y-A-M. Eh? I am what I am and that's all right. And that's ne'er the truth was more betterly spoken than that. I mean, I am a war, peace-loving, hate-mongering carnivore. I am what I am and that's what I am. I mean, you know? I mean, it's very difficult for a fox to stand in front of a group of rabbits and apologize for being a fox when all the rabbits know that he's a fox and all the foxes know that the rabbits are rabbits. And, you know, it gets all quite convoluted. But these two guys are sitting there. By the way, I got a beautiful postcard the other day. The guy says, dear Mr. Shepherd, what is this monotonous drivel that you're droning on and on and on about? When are you going to start making sense and talk about some important things like the news? Well, I take the point well. One thing about me, I can go to my right. Pretty good here. While I'm sitting on my duff, though, the thing, you're really interested now in this. I don't want to cause any trouble. Well, actually, seriously, underneath it all, I do want to cause trouble because I am a man. Now, when I say man, I'm saying it in the small sense. That means all of mankind, see. And not the man that reads Playboy, you know, this jazz. I'm talking about man. All right, I'm a man. Man, you know, you're a man. Everybody's man. That chick over there, man, you know, mankind, in a mankind sense. So naturally, by definition, we want to cause trouble. Do you really mean right? Do you mean well? I didn't think so. Do you mean well? That's right. I didn't think so either. I could just hear somebody out in Babylon some friendly little old lady with three cats, a dog, and two ferns, saying, "For heaven's sakes, what is this? Of course I mean well. What does he mean?" And she's sitting there, and she's been she's been mongering hate of one kind or another at every card party her family has thrown for the last four generations. But then again, as long as you're going to face it, we might as well. They were sitting there on the shore of this lake. For the purposes of discussion, we'll call one of them Og and the others Charlie. We do not know their actual names. It's been that long. And they're both sitting there, and they're... You know, the interesting thing about man in those days, he crouched more than he does now. He was, which means that he was more honest. He wasn't afraid to crouch down and show the rest of the world that he was afraid of the sky falling in on him. He didn't pretend by keeping his knees flexed. And so he just crouched, and he also knew, you see, that when the sky did fall, there was nothing he could do about it, which is different. We pretend now that we can do something about it. And eternally, every 20 years, the sky has fallen down and killed at least 14 million. Now, we like to pretend that we are a 20th century man. This is, of course, modern civilized man. It's interesting to note that more civilized modern men have died from the hand of his other brother civilized modern man than in all recorded history prior to 1900. We are getting to the point where, of course, it is true that technology has its own particular fascination, particularly when we apply it to the things like we really want, like killing everybody. This is true progress. I remember the sad stories, all the sad stories after the war, when they were talking about how atomic energy was going to bring a new age to mankind. It has, actually. You notice that haggard look that everybody has? That skulking look that everybody sneaks around with? And now, how many years? 15 years after the first atom bomb was blasted? Well, we're in the new age, you know. The age of the new ones. But these two guys were crouched down, and they were looking out over that dark and placid sea. And they were crouched. They were legitimately and honestly crouched. And there's another thing about man in that period. He was much more washable than he is now. He was covered with hair, which was... they hadn't discovered, the one-minute commercial yet, the singing commercial that told them how terrible it was to smell. And they kind of enjoyed it in those days, oddly enough. It gave them a sense of togetherness, you know, because it was the only real communication that they ever had between one another. They hadn't yet discovered how to really talk. They just sniffed. And so they sat there, and incidentally, that's a very fascinating thing, you see. Because no matter how a man speaketh, no matter how orotund his tones, no matter how robust his verse form, no matter how impregnable his society has become, the aroma remains the same. And this, you see, can be taken as, in one sense, the only true universal that exists. And we devote more time and effort in the United States to eradicating that than any other single universal that I know of, which has something to do with I don't know what yet at this time. I'm mulling it over. We've got it in the mull. We'll see what happens. We're shaking the dice. Let's see. We're crumbling the cookie. I figure that the ants will come up one day in some Chinese fortune cookie and let it, you know. But these two guys are sitting there, and they're crouched down. And once in a while, one would shift his position ever so slightly, which led to the only noise that was man-created up to that point, which was an occasional cracking knee, a very comforting sound. You know, one of the most comforting things that happened to me in a long time, I ever tell you about my one brief brush with a president? Yes. Well, I sat next to a president one day. The president came in, sat down on this railroad car. They had a railroad car, one of these private cars, you know, with the leather chairs went around. And I'm sitting there, and the president sat down, and his knee cracked. Oh, my George. Well, I don't have anything to fear from this guy. His knees crack. Just like mine. And it kind of made me feel... it made me feel two things. One, it made me feel comfortable. Also, scared me. That anybody who is like I am is worth nothing. And really, in a sense, is going to be the end of us all, you see. So I look at him, I says, he's like me. Oh, no, of course not. That was my knee I heard cracking. No, his knees don't crack. But I was wrong there. See, his knees do crack. They do and did crack. And so these two guys are sitting there, once in a while their knees crack. And they're looking out over the sea. This is a historic moment, and is the instant when man became man, M-A-N. It's interesting to note that the other day, Henry Morgan made a remark about me. He says, Shepherd is always looking into the past. He's always remembering his childhood. That's true. So did Proust. That's true. So did Thomas Wolfe. That's true. So did, what was his name? It doesn't matter. I mean, so did, what was his name? Archie. Archie the cockroach, who spoke eternally of his youth. And those wonderful spun dreams that were broken upon the rocks of the now and the yesteryear. And so, of course, I'm speaking of all of our youths here. And once in a while, the sun... Oh, by the way, the only man who can have any breadth at all, incidentally, in this world, in any world, is one who does remember his youth. In short, has a sense of the history of the time in which he has lived. That the man who remembers yesterday in the office is the man who knows something about today in the office. And I'm not speaking on behalf of nostalgia here at all. Oh, no. I'm speaking of jungle cunning. I'm speaking about the tiger who, after having been shot several times, learns about shooting and knows how to move easily and gracefully through those long, winding pathways. The man who forgets his youth is rapidly on the way and towards becoming an interesting sort of psychopath, a most intriguing psychopath, of which we have, and of course, the littoral is dotted. And speaking of dotted littorals, Og and Charlie are sitting there, and they're looking out over that ancient sea. Everything was gray in those days. I mean, really gray. Gray. No air conditioning. Nowhere. There were no hot dog stands. Nothing. It's hard to believe there weren't even cabs. You know, it's interesting. There are places where they don't even know a cab. Even to this day, of course, we'll carry civilization to them. But the two of them are sitting there looking out over this ancient sea. And there hadn't been a single change of expression for over 500 years on the continents of mankind. And the two of them just sat. Storms came. Night rose and night fell. The stars blazed overhead and the gray skies arched always. And they looked. And then one fateful afternoon, just after Charlie had come back from gathering a few clams down at the waterside, Og turned to him, looked at him for a long instant that went on for maybe 6 or 7 more years. Just looked. Things moved much slower in ancient times than they do today. And then, without saying a word, he reached down, picked up a large stone, raised it above his head, and brought it down with a telling, fatal crash between the eyes of Charlie. And that instant, man became man. He ceased being a beastie of the field. He no longer could return to the world of flowers. Never again could he pretend that he was like the clams. That moment, modern man was born. That instant. It was the great, great turning point. And Charlie fell in a pool of blood. Og settled back on his haunches and continued to look out over the lake. But they were seen by another man who crouched by his cave. He picked up a rock and moved into the shadow. And waited. Modern man had begun to progress. Abba, I want to know. I want to know that I am going to go standing pat. Standing pat. Standing clean and pat. With naught else but tears. Naught else but sighs. Ba 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 ooh. Not yet. Not yet. Not yet. But now.
Drive with confidence on General Tires. You don't take a chance with General Tires. You can drive anywhere with never a care. Cause you know your General Tires will get you there. General's Line of Tires meets all the rest. Cost a little more and you get the best. Your driving days will be worry-free. Drive with confidence on General Tires.
Only $2 more than the lowest-priced ordinary tires gives you all these extra values of famous General Safety Milers. Rugged 7-rib tread, shock-absorber construction, extra mileage, recapability. See your General Tire dealer today for the easiest terms in town.
There, I presume that made sense to all of you. Don't put that away. Hey, Ralph, hold that one up because I'm going to use that again. Because this theme of the wondrous scheme. Yeah, the same cut. Same cut. The one we just used. Not the General Tire, but the you know. I want them six. There is a line in that piece of work that I will never forget. And it says so much about man. At St. James Infirmary. And I want to go and I can see myself. Those big white horses are drawn up that old cart. But there's one thing I want to do. I want to have that $20 gold piece hanging from my watch chain because I want them to know that I died standing pat. Speaking of death, this is WOR AM and FM New York, the Big Apple. And we'll be here until, doesn't make any difference. I mean, how long are you going to be there? I mean, what difference does it make, you know? Why do we have this, why are we so bugged with time in our world? This has to do with the secret fears. There are some radio stations right down the dial from me here who rarely go more than, maybe 30 seconds without telling you the time. And you can just hear your life dripping away between the assorted shouts of the various hit records of the day. And every 30 seconds, the guy comes on and says, the time now, 4:32, and now it's time to drop into our weather tower to find out just what that weather is over great big old Manhattan. And this is WWRBR with the top 40, and we'll be right back in just 30 seconds. And then they go on and on and on. Of course, the time. And some poor guy is sitting out there working in the garage. You know, he's down underneath a car and he's changing tires and he's been draining transmissions. And it's exactly this kind of place where this radio plays all the time. Little old wooden radios, little five-tube radios that were made about 15 years ago. They have little green dials that glow fitfully. And the radio is constantly telling him the time and incessantly reminding him that it's all up, that the jig will be up any minute now. And stay tuned for the weather. Stay tuned for the weather. We'll let you know what the gods think now. And look out. Look out. Look out. It's now 4:32 and you're still there. Nothing has happened. Oh, yeah. Nothing has happened. Oh, yeah. Stay tuned for the next tune. Stay tuned for the next hit. And stay tuned for the next Socko Smash hit time, which will be 4:23. And it'll never come back again. 4:23. Ever. And that old fear, you know, that old wonderful sneaking thing. That old wonderful sneaky little side issue of the people who walk back and forth on the rostrum, on the ancient convention floor that we're all part of, the people in the white suits that keep walking back and forth, just out of camera range, but just in camera range, in front of the main speaker. They keep diverting your eyes. They're always there. And the guy who puts a big sign up in front of the camera once in a while that says, Idaho, he's there too. And they're all moving back and forth until finally you want to have an eternal commentator who can somehow bring it all together for you. There's an ancient, very ancient English rhyme with an E on the end. It's so ancient. When they spelled English with an A and an E, it is so ancient. And they posed the same question. I want to die standing pat. And then when I die, I can see myself laying there all stretched out. The eternal dream that somehow you're going to be able to see yourself lying there in state. I saw a peacock with a fiery tail. I saw a blazing comet drop down hail. I saw a cloud rapid with ivy round. I saw an oak creep on along the ground. I saw a pismire swallow up a whale. I saw the sea brim full of ale. I saw a Venice glass, 5 fathom deep. And I saw a well full of men's tears that weep. I saw red eyes all of a flaming fire. I saw a house bigger than the moon and higher than that. I saw the sun at 12 o'clock at night. And I saw the man that saw this wondrous sight. Da da do do dee da do, ba ba pia u ba ba u, ba 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 u ba I. Are you interested in any more poems of this ancient fear? All right, set her back, Ralph. I'll tell you what we'll take now. Get rid of that piano playing there and give me. Hey, call her there. Whistle to her quickly. Come here. Now, don't worry about the thing. Dig out among the records there. Get me a guitar record, but I want the green covered one. The green cover. No. Actually, I'll tell you. Yeah, give me the green cover. Yeah. Give me the green cover. And now the green cover. No. Now, to put it down, that isn't the one. There's the green one. There we go. Now, inside that, you will find some cuts marked, yes, you will. Huh? It's clean. What do you mean by clean? Oh, I see. But you'll find, I don't mean marked cuts, I mean titles of cuts. You will find some cuts titled, S-O-R. You see where it says S-O-R? Look on the label, Ralph. It'll say S-O-R. S-O-R. Yeah, okay. Play both of those cuts and set it back. And I'm ready. I'll read you some poetry that's based on this terrible fear. This what fear am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about the fear. I'm not talking about any other. I'm not talking about Nasser. I ain't talking about Castro. That's small-time potatoes. I'm talking about the fear that causes the Nassers and the Castros and that causes things that we know not of. And I will read you some poems of this fear. Yes. All right. Here's a piece of poetry entitled The Wheel Go Round. Again, it's that fear of the inexplicable, which is the eternal enigma. And it's not to be so simply answered as to just call it the why. That ain't it. It's also the where. It's also the question that asks of what, which is the most sneaky of all the questions. And of course, these are all questions. And within the space of 10 minutes, there will be 400 people who will leap up with the answers, to be replaced, of course, within the next 10 minutes by 400 other people, waving books, usually, in hand. I went into a sort of house and watched some sort of wheels go round. They were the hugest kind of wheels and made a pleasant sort of sound. It was a gaily lighted place with many windows near the top. The wheels kept going round and round. It didn't seem that they'd ever stop. It was the strangest sort of house, all full of numbers set in glass, and thoughtful men all dressed in blue, and shining dials, and things of brass. I walked up to a man in blue. I stopped the man in blue and said, "What makes the shining wheels go round?" The fellow shook his snowy head. "What makes the shining wheels go round?" I asked the oldest man in blue. He took a piece of chalk he had and wrote a number, bright and new. He wrote a number, bright and new. He brought a little book he had. He took the book and in it read, "What makes the shining wheels go round? The wheel go rounding one is dead. The wheel go rounding one is dead." I took the little book, and I found myself all dressed in blue. And as I looked, my hair turned snow. Who knows if the moon's a balloon coming out of a keen city in the sky, filled with pretty people? And if you and I should get into it, if they should take me and take you into their balloon, why then we'd go up higher with all the pretty people and houses and steeples and clouds, go sailing away and away, sailing into a keen city which nobody's ever visited, where always it's spring and everyone's in love and flowers pick themselves. When Sam goes back in memory to where the sea breaks on the shingle, emerald green and white foam endlessly, he says with small brown eyes on mine, "I used to keep awake and lean from my window in the moon, watching those billows break, and 500,000 tiny hands and eyes like sparks of frost would dance and come tumbling into the moon on every breaker tossed. And from all across, from star to star, I've seen the watery sea with not a single ship in sight. Just ocean there and me. And heard my father snore. And once, as sure as I'm alive, out of those wallowing moon-flecked waves, I saw a mermaid dive, head and shoulders above the wave, plain as I now see you, combing her hair, now back, now front, her two eyes peeping through, calling me, Sam, quiet like Sam, Sam. But me, I never went, making believe I kind of thought 'twas someone else she meant. Wonderful lovely there she sat, singing the night away, all in the solitudinous sea of that there lonely bay. Perhaps, and he'd smooth his hairless mouth, perhaps if it were now, my son, perhaps if I heard a voice say, Sam, morning would find me gone. Gone to where? That's the question. Of the which and of the why, and of the now and of the perhaps. Slowly, silently now, the moon walks the night in her silver shoon. This way and that she peers, and sees silver fruit upon silver trees. One by one, the casements catch her beams beneath the silvery thatch. Couched in his kennel like a log, with paws of silver sleeps the dog. From their shadowy coat, the white breasts peep of doves in a silver-feathered sleep. A harvest mouse goes scampering by with silver claws and silver eye, and moveless fish in the water gleam by silver reeds in a silver stream. But what stream? And why silver? Which is the loneliest and the most frightening of colors? Silver. For that reason, one of the few colors people really speak of, my favorite color. It's always green or red or blue or yellow, rarely silver. And the one who says silver, Be careful of that one. Be careful. Who calls? Who calls? Let it go into the next. Who calls? Who? Did you call? Did you? Who calls? And that's the end of the poem. Who calls? I heard a sound. No, it wasn't a sound, I guess. I thought there was somebody there. There must be somebody there. My imagination. My imagination. When the night wind howls in the chimney cowls and the bat in the moonlight flies in inky clouds like funeral shrouds sail over the midnight skies, when the footpads quail at the nightbird's wail and black dogs bay the moon, then is the specter's holiday, then is the ghost's high noon. As the sob of the breeze sweeps over the trees and the mists lie low on the fen, from gray tombstones are gathered the bones that once were women and men. And away they go, with a mop and a mow, to the revel that ends too soon. For cockcrow limits our holiday, the dead of the night's high noon. And then each ghost with his lady toast to their churchyard beds take flight, with a kiss perhaps on their lantern chaps and a grisly grim good night. Till the welcome knell of the midnight bell rings forth its jolliest tune and ushers our next high holiday, the dead of the night's high noon. Again, the eternal belief that we're all alive always. Og and Charlie are still with us, looking over our shoulders with their dim, uncomprehending, sad gray eyes. And we'll be looking over the shoulders of someone else with our dim, incomprehending, sad gray eyes. 1,000 years from now, the great dream that everyone still lives and the bones dance at midnight and the revels go on and on. The revels, the song and the grisly kiss continues to go. The cat was once a weaver. A weaver. A weaver. An old and withered weaver who labored late and long. And while she made the shuttle hum and wove the weft and clipped the thrum, beside the loom with droning drum she sang the weaving song. Three threads on the thrum, thrum. The cat's no more a weaver. A weaver, a weaver. An old and wrinkled weaver. For though she did no wrong, a witch hath changed the shape of her, that dwindled down and clothed in fur, beside the hearth with droning purr, she thrums her weaving song. Thrum. The next one, well, thrum. Three threads in the thrum, thrum, on and on. That even the animals that live with us know. They too were once us. This is another dream that constantly pops up in mankind's steady, steady flight from what he is and steady, steady fear of what he thinks he might be. And in every religion, always pops up the head of the animal somewhere along the line. The animal that fell from grace and ceased to be a man. all of a sudden the big nasturtiums rose in the night from the ocean's bed, rested a while in the light of the morning, turning the sand dunes tiger red. They climbed the statue of Abraham Lincoln. They covered it to the top, our church's spire. Grandpa, Grandpa, come to the window. Come to the window, our world's on fire. Big nasturtiums in the high Sierras. Big nasturtiums in the lands below. Our trains are late, and our planes have fallen. And out in the ocean, the whistles blow. Over the fields and over the forests, over the living. And yes, over the dead. I never expected the big nasturtiums to come in my lifetime, Grandpa said. The big nasturtiums. The big red nasturtiums. Now, a little old lady out in Staten Island. It's true that Shepherd makes no sense. But the question now hangs in air, do you? Does Edward R. Murrow? Does Pandit Nehru? Does anything or anyone? A strange foreboding is o'er me. My heart is idly fraught. I've heard of an olden story that will not out of my thought. The air is cool and darkling, and the Rhine is still below. The peak of the mountain is sparkling in evening, the afterglow. And there sits, and there gleams a maiden, yonder so high and fair, with golden jewels laden, combing her golden hair. Have you noticed there has never been, to my knowledge, a myth of a man that lures to the death? Have you noticed? It is always a maiden, wondrous fair and golden. And even today, throughout all of our own little myths, there lurks that maiden, wondrous fair. Listen to Mike and Elaine. And there is that maiden, wondrous fair, that lures to death on the rocks below. She combs her hair with a comb that is golden, and ever singing is she, a song of mysterious, olden, and mighty melody. It seizes with wildest sorrow the boatman ferrying by, and he recks not of rock nor of narrow, and he gazes only on high. I doubt not that the wave will devour the boat and the boatman ere long. And that was the Lorelei's power. And that was the Lorelei's song. Are you interested in who wrote that? That wasn't Edgar Guest. That wasn't Nick Kenny. That was from Dorothy Kilgallen. Listen to this magnificent piece written by the same man. Under the linden, the music is gay. The couples are gossiping loudly, and two are dancing whom nobody knows. They carry themselves so proudly. Now here, now there, they glide and sway in wave-like measures, beguiling. They bow to each other, and as they nod, she whispers, gently smiling, "A water pink is hanging from your cap, my fair young dancer. It only grows in the depths of the sea. You are no mortal man, sir. You are a merman, and to lure these village maids your wish is. I knew you at once by your watery eyes and your teeth as sharp as the fish's. Now here, now there, they glide and sway in wave-like measures, beguiling. They bow to each other, and as they nod, he answers, gently smiling, 'My lovely lady, tell me why your hand's so cold and shiny? And why is the border of your gown so damp and draggled and briny? I knew you at once by your watery eyes and your bow so mocking and tricksy. You are never a daughter of earth, my dear. You are my cousin, the Nixie. The fiddles are silent. The dancing is done. They part with a ripple of laughter. They know each other too well, and will try to avoid such a meeting hereafter. What Nixie? What merman? Luring to where? Where do you think you're going, Jack? A baby? Queenie? Where do you think you're going? Sit on my knee, my dear. We will speak of mermen. Look into my watery eyes. And then listen to this. Also the fear of the dark, somber places. Drank lonesome water. Weren't but a tad then, up in a laurel thick, digging for sang. Came on a place where the stones was holler. Something below them tinkled and rang. Dug where I heard it, dripping below me. Should have known better, should have been wise. Leaned down and drank it, clutching and gripping. The overhang cliv with the ferns in my eyes. Twern't no tame water, I knowed in a minute. Must have been laying there, projecting round since winter went home. Must have laid like a cushions where the feet of the blossoms was tucked in the ground. Tasted of heart leaf, and that smells the sweetest. Pawpaw and spice bush and wild briar rose. Must have been counting the heels of the spruce pines, the neighboring round where angelica grows. I had drunk lonesome water. I knowed it in a minute. Never learnt nothing from then till today. Nothing worth learning, nothing worth knowing. I'm bound to the hills and I can't get away. Mean, sort of dried-up old groundhoggy feller laying out cold here watching the sky, poor as a whippoorwill bent like a grass blade, counting up stars till they count too high. I know where the gray foxes uses up yonder. I know what'll cure you of physic or chills, but I never been away from here. Never got going. I've drunk lonesome water. I'm bound to the hills. And there are a lot of us who have drunk lonesome water. Some of us drink lonesome water and some of us don't. And those that drink lonesome water will never dance on Broadway. Those that drink lonesome water will never hang in the Metropolitan Museum. Those that drank lonesome water just lay on their backs and count the stars until the stars count up to a billion or more and then go on. And who knows when we drank it and how it tasted, but it did taste mighty sweet at first. And you never get the taste of it out of your mouth once you've tasted it. Once you drank lonesome water. That's another way of saying it. Of how come you're here sitting on your duff listening when you should be at Sardi's wearing green glasses. With the elfin ones are, those with the golden wand and the silver touch. How come you sit out there on the fire escape and look into the darkling street below? You drink lonesome water. Terrible old lonesome water. Are you interested in any more of these? On their shoulder and an ivory bow in their hand. Seven fiddlers came with their fiddles, a-fiddling through the land, and they fiddled a tune on their fiddles that none could understand. Everywhere you notice, when that fear comes a-sneaking up on you, it's accompanied by music. The maiden sings, the trees hum, and the fiddlers fiddle. For none who heard their fiddling might keep his 10 toes still. Even the cripple threw down his crutches and danced against his will. Young and old, they all fell a-dancing while the fiddlers fiddled their fill. They fiddled down to the ferry by Severn's side, and they stepped aboard the ferry, none else to row or guide, and deftly steered the pilot, and stoutly the oars they plied. Then suddenly in mid-channel these fiddlers ceased to row, and the pilot spake to his fellows in a tongue that none may know. Let us home to our fathers and brothers and the maidens we love below. Then the fiddlers seized their fiddles and sang to their fiddles a song. We're coming, coming, oh brothers, to the home we have left so long, for the world still loves the fiddler, and the fiddler's tune is strong. Then they stepped from out the ferry into the Severn Sea, down into the depths of the water where the homes of the fiddlers be. And the ferry boat drifted slowly forth to the ocean, free. But where those jolly fiddlers walk down into the deep, the ripples are never quiet, but forever dance and leap, though the Severn Sea be silent and the winds be all asleep. Interested in any more of these? Oh, yes. There's another fear that man has. And that's the fear that he might change into something else. The fear that he might become what his worst fears say he is. No wonder we create Frankenstein monsters, because that monster represents one part of us that stalks the night. No wonder we write of Dracula, the Count, who supped on others and their blood, because this represents another phase, another tiny facet. I am out on the wind in the wild black night. On the wings of the owl I take my flight, on the ghostly wings of the great white owl. And whether the night be fair or foul, or the moon be up or the thunder growl, happy I be. Happy I be when the changeling blood runs green in me. When the meek folk sleep in their dull, soft beds, I creep over roots that the weasel treads, where the squat green lamps of the toadstools glow, and only the fox knows the ways I go, and nobody knows the things I know. Wise I be. Wise I be when the changeling blood runs green in me. Mothers slumber and do not wake. Thin voices call from the wet rain break. And the child you cradled against your breast is out in the night on the black wind's crest. For only the wild can give me rest. Sad I be. Sad I be when the changeling blood runs green. Only the wild can give me rest. Who can sit here and deny that Count Dracula was more interesting than anyone around him? Who can sit here and deny that Count Dracula did not live for that brief moment while he fluttered through the flame? Who cannot but silently, somehow, sullenly envy Frankenstein's monster? Yes. Happy I be, happy I be when the changeling blood runs green in me. Sad I be, sad I be when the changeling blood runs green in me. I can just hear that wonderful little old lady out in Forest Hills saying, "What's this young man talking about? What are you listening to in there?" But the 15-year-old kid who listens to me knows what I'm talking about, Daddy. Because he ain't yet set that mold. He knows about the wild things that go bump in the night, and the dark shadows behind the overshoes in the closet. Speaking of the dark shadows that go bump in the night, this is WOR, AM and FM in New York. For the changeling blood runs green every half hour, and happy and sad we be, as the commercial log rises and falls with the ascending and the descending tides of man. Are you sure you want any more? No. Ralph is tired. He wants to talk about baseball scores and football games. Let me tell you, you know, it's a funny thing. No. I'm not going to be coerced into this. Mind, George? I've watched long and hard. And I've come to some conclusions about the looks on the faces of people when they're confronted with things which, for one reason or another, I don't think the business of understanding is a matter of intellect. I think it is a matter of will and choice. And I also think that it is a matter that in many instances goes beyond that which somebody told me an idiotic little gag. And it kind of points this up. And I'll tell you where the gag was told to me. It was a terrible thing. I was down on my knees changing a tire in the rain. And this guy's standing over me with a flashlight, and he says, "You know, this reminds me of a joke." I said, "Oh, yeah, it would." Only, this is an interesting facet of man. Men, I can say, that only men can laugh in the face of disaster. Women can't. I've never seen a woman who could. Not real disaster. It's the kind of humor that will make a guy go through 3 years of training in the army, you know. He is kicked from pillar to post for the first 4 months taking his basic training. And then, you know, he goes from one thing to the other. And each thing gets, it's like a rising crescendo of indecency that is heaped upon him. One thing after the other until he finally is stripped naked of everything. He has not even the slightest pin feather of society left back in that little dark recess in the underarm of man. And there he is, you see. He's now naked. They put him on a boat that at one time was called the Ile de France, some beautiful ancient vessel that carried the steaming orgiastic hordes to Europe and back. And they put him on a boat, and he goes all the way over, see, someplace. And then they put him on another boat. They blow the whistle. He's charging up the beach, and he sees coming right down at him an 88 shell. And he knows it's all over. And in that last split second, he lasts his fool head off just before the shell takes it off for good. And I have seen him do it. Now, I know of no woman who could do this, or does. And this is an interesting thing. I'm going to get a lot of indignant letters immediately from women claiming they do. Now, this is not, I'm not against, nor am I, this is not an anti-woman or a pro-woman thing. Interestingly enough, anytime you point out the difference, that there is a difference between men and women, women get mad and all men nod their heads. It's fascinating, you know? And so I'm down there on my knees, you see, and the rain is coming down and I'm changing a tire. I'm 400 miles away from any civilization or any air pump. And I'm working way down there in the mire. I think it's good for a man to have a flat tire occasionally. I mean a real flat in his power steering, power windowed, power top monster. Once in a while, and I mean a flat where he's way out somewhere with no spare, where he's got to wrestle with the soil. Boom! And then instantly his Chris crap has been scuttling. He goes, blum, blum, blum. He feels the road for the first time in 4 years, and he gets out, and he looks at this thing that's all flat and laying all over the ground there, and he said, "What's this?" He gets out his instruction book, and it says, "You have a flat tire. Here's what you do now. You take that big, round, shiny thing off, and you take that other thing that's in the trunk, that big, long thing that rattles. You take that out, and you stick it under your bumper, and you start to pump. And one of the most precarious things in today's world is pumping up a modern, gigantic Chris Craft car up on one of those tiny, spindly jacks. They just ain't made to be jacked up. I mean, you know, it's like putting matchsticks under a whale. And this thing is going up, and you finally get, and I'm down there on my knees, you see, with this giant looming over me. And, of course, you know, there's a sense of impending doom there, too. And I'm taking off the tire, and it's raining, and the guy says, "This reminds me of a thing." I said, what? This is a gag. I says, okay. And he says, well, there were two guys, you see, and they're in this home. They're in this home for the incurably insane. And they're working away on something. And they're trying to change the tire on a car that's on the grounds there, and they're working around and they're working away there, and they got the nuts and the bolts off. And it turns out that one of the bolts has been lost. And so one of the guys stands up there and he says to the other guys, I tell you what, let's do. Let's take one off of each one and we'll get them all, we'll even them all up that way, you see, and there'll be one missing on each one. That way we won't have any trouble, which makes sense, technically. And so the guy looks up, he says, gee, that's a great idea. And the second one says, look, I may be insane, but I'm not stupid. Now, that's exactly what I'm talking about, you see. We like to confuse the insane with the stupid. And then and incidentally, I have found that many of the insane are the sanest I have ever met. It is the sanity, the very sanity, that drives them over the brink. This is another problem which we have not yet come to grips with. But the thing that I have noticed is the wonderful, bored, stony face that comes upon a man when he is confronted with that which he never concerns himself with. The inexplicable, the unknown, the secret sneaking fears. He becomes then bored, interestingly enough. And I guess this is nature's way of protecting the fool. Is the only thing I can say about that, you know? It's what they say about drunks, and what else is it that nature protects? Well, I also say that it protects something else. And it's this curtain that descends, this wonderful curtain of righteousness and total knowledge that descends over the complete boob who knows exactly how he's going to vote and why, and figures that he has his life all calculated out, and he knows exactly what it's about and where it's leading him. And yet, you know, it's interesting. I knew a boob one time, a real boob. I mean, what I call a boob. I mean, an intelligent. You know what I mean by the boob? The guy who will hear the song of the changeling and say, what's this idiot talking about? But yet at the same time, who seems to operate well in the society. You know, the more boob you become, I found, in our society, and when I say boob, I'm using it in the Mencken terms. The more boobish you are, the better you will make it in our society. In almost all the society, because there's never any question, you know, about what to do or what not to do. And so the interesting thing about the boob, though, is that he has his doubts occasionally. And when he has his doubts, he generally attacks those around him who cause the doubt to come into being. You know, this is a fascinating thing. Like the time I'm sitting in a sales meeting, and the sales meeting is drumming on, and they're talking about Operation Dynamic, which was going to be our new operation for the fall. You know, this is going to put us right over the top. Operation Dynamic. We have these big charts and graphs and all the slides and the little films and stuff. This is, by the way, this is one of the major industries now in our abstract world, is the presentation, where one man presents something to another man. Actually, it's one group presents something to another group, and it's a kind of self-affirmation thing, where they all sit around waiting for the hosannas to rise and the hallelujahs. And if the hallelujahs are scattered, then they bring out another prayer rug and try again, you see. And the gods become ourselves, you see. We hosanna each other, or hallelujah each other, or strike each other with bolts of lightning. And so we're constantly propitiating the gods with our various presentations of one kind or another, our films and our excoriating shouts to the heavens, constantly hoping that the gods will smile, namely the sales manager this time. And then the sales manager hopes that the agency reps will smile. And the agency reps hope that the sponsors will smile. And the sponsors hope that the public will smile. And the public hopes that the TV set will smile. And then it goes all the way around, and the full circle comes, and it is nothing but a gigantic, an ancient druidic ring of supplicants, all of them looking up into the darkening sky, waiting for the message. But that's neither here nor there. And so, but it is, you see, here and there. I'm sitting there in the middle of the sales meeting, and this clown suddenly says, well, he raises his hand and he says, what happened to Operation Windfall? That was last year's operation, see, that was going to bring us into the safe harbor. And there's a dead silence. And somebody says, well, this is a new year. We have Operation Dynamic now. He says, yeah, but what? I mean, it's a new year, but it really isn't. We're all here. It's just me and you. And the year is just a thing we thought of. Actually, you know, the sun came up and the sun came down, and now we got Operation Dynamic. And there's a kind of a funny chuckle. And then after the guy leaves, about three of them are getting in there. Says, what is this, this beatnik idiot? Oh, what a pain in the duff. And anyway, I had this friend who was a boob, and he was a true boob, in that never a doubt ever ruffled the placid stream of his existence. And one day, this boob friend of mine, of course, whenever any of us would talk about the world at large and in general, about things that be and the things that aren't, he would say, oh, come on, what is this beatnik? You know, interesting now, anything that smacks of trouble is now dismissed as beatnik talk. I love that. Oh, daddy-o. And so this guy, this is a kind of an interesting little, I don't know whether it has a moral or not, but this boob friend of mine, of course, naturally, he was important. All boobs are. And he was one of the guiding forces in the organization. Well, one day, he gets out of his car on the wrong side and got hit by a cab. It knocked him 400 feet in the air and 35 feet down a side street. There was a perfect divot shot. And they picked him up, and they took him off to the hospital, and they put things all over him, and they wrapped him up and poured concrete around him and made him completely immobile and put pulleys over his head. And then they put a chart above his head, and the chart kept going up and down. And it went down oftener than went up. And he's up there looking at it, see? And I came to see him after they finally allowed visitors to come in. And he has a new look in his eye. And I'm looking at him, and he's lying there, and I said something to the effect, how you feeling, Charlie? He says, what difference does it make? I says, what do you mean, what difference does it make? How do you feel, you idiot? He says, well, I guess all right. And so he slowly mended. He finally made it back to the land of the living. He came back to the office. He was there 2 weeks, and he had a fist fight with our boss. About the very thing that we had been talking about for years. This business of Operation Dynamic. Well, he had joined us. Now, I don't know whether he was worse off or better off. You see, I can't tell. He had drunk lonesome water, is what he had done. You know, there was a fascinating little item, and I'm going to read this item to you. Don't go away, because this one, it's a story about a guy named Oliver Starling who put in three false alarms in a row here in Manhattan the other day. I'm more and more convinced that your name has to do with what you are. Let me see if I can find this piece. Oh, this is a great piece. Now, don't go away. It's a clipping. It's a clipping that'll make your hair stand on end. Wait a minute. Don't go away. Oh, can't find it. I can find everything I don't want every time I do. Look at all this jazz. Why not loud? Where do they all go? Complete fiasco. I'm always amused when somebody writes me. About every 3 days, somebody writes me and says, hey, I met a guy who writes your script for you, Shepard. Try not loud. I'd like to meet him myself. He's a reason why I'm not getting anywhere. I'd like to meet that guy that writes this. No, I wish I could find it because... Okay, hold on here. Oh, yes, here's something I wanted to mention. How about it? You know, 30 seconds after I go off the air, there will be three copies of that thing here. All hanging onto my coffee cup. Right in front of my nose, see, by magic. You see, this is what makes a guy believe in the, you know, it makes him wonder. There's this kind of thing here. Here you go. No. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's one little interesting thing that came out the other day. I'm sitting there looking at a magazine, and it's a magazine about the U.S. Bureau of Standards. I mean, this is an interesting bureau when you start to think of it. We recently had to appoint a committee to find out what the standards of America are, and we've got a whole bureau devoted to standards. And so here, you know, there's pictures of guys sitting there weighing things, and guys with official foot measurements, and guys with meters of all sorts. And there in the middle, this is the most enigmatic picture I have seen in years. And I clipped it out and brought it in. It's a fantastic little picture. There's a very scholarly looking guy who looks something like Douglas Edwards. You know, Douglas Edwards Curtis, the leader of the Sunday school class when he was 9, has become the news commentator. You know, this look. And this Douglas Edwards looking kind of guy is weighing something, and he's writing things down on a scale. He's making a notation, and it says U.S. Bureau of Standards photo. And you see behind him, all the way to the ceiling and all around him, nothing but files with all kinds of little tags, and he's there weighing things. And in front of him are three packages of file cards. You get this? With rubber bands bound around them. Three packages of file cards. One is a complete file cabinet, you know, the little metal drawer that pulls out. There are two packages. One of them is on the scale, and one is to the other side of the scale. Now, you got it? Three packages of files. And very plainly, you can read what the files are about. One of them is marked Sin. And that is the one that has the biggest file card. You know? And then you see underneath that, you see two file drawers, each one of them marked Love. And on top of it is an extra package of file cards marked Love. That means that there are 2.5 drawers of Love in the Bureau of Standards, one drawer of Sin, and then the real kicker, there's a little package of file cards that is about 1.5 inches thick with a rubber band around it marked Eternity. And I'm telling you, I'm reading this, I'm looking at this thing, and here's this very dry article, you see, about weights and measures and scales and wavelength measurements and all that jazz. And in the middle of it all, here is the guy, and he's weighing the package of cards that say Eternity. Somehow the Bureau of Standards is more concerned with the weight of eternity than the meaning of it, apparently. And he's weighing it there. And I thought, what are they doing? Editorializing again down there? What are they preparing for me? I would like to get into that file card, the one marked Sin. Do you realize that there's a whole file card, a whole cabinet full of things on sin? It's like that little note that I read the other day. There was a guy out in the Pacific Coast somewhere. Get me my ominous guitar music. Or what do you got up there, Ralph? You got something fairly ominous there? No, I think it's not ominous. Just whatever you got there. That's all right. We make it easy for everybody here. Okay. Oh no, that'll never do. That's Roseland Ballroom. Don't get mad, Ralph. That's all right. We're all working here together. Now try that next one then. It's all right. It's all fun. Just let it. See, pretend that you're fishing and you got a nibble and he got away. Okay? Ah, yes, this makes it fit. Of course, this makes it fit. All right, I'd like to tell you what one of our fellow citizens did recently. In case you're interested in the nature of man and what makes sense and what doesn't. You know, the only function of the artist is to try to make it make sense, which he never quite fully achieves. There is no such thing as a fulfilled artist, if he's an artist. He is constantly running after a retreating electric rabbit. Constantly running after it. I mean, so, look, lady out there in Staten Island, I don't know what makes sense either. I'm not sure you know. Someday I'd like to invite you over to have you tell me. We'll go down to Schraft's. And we'll have a raisin bun. And we'll talk about that nice Mr. Eisenhower, okay? And about how it makes sense. I remember this fantastic photo. Speaking of that nice Mr. Eisenhower, And it was done in complete deadpan. It shows Ike on the golf course. A photo. This was not an editorial thing. It was just a photo. He's wearing that white cap, and sitting next to him is a rich billionaire, one of the constant friends. And they're sitting in this little caddy cart with a little umbrella over them. And a guy has come up. You can see an official-looking guy with a briefcase, and he's given Mr. Eisenhower some papers. And it says, Ike keeps constant touch with Congo situation while on golf course. I said, yes, sir, Daddy, that's a pure American. I could just see him. He reads this and...